spring started yesterday, allegedly, even though the weather doesn't seem to be playing along. And as it turns out, Wisconsin is a big birding state, and a lot of people are getting the urge to head outside.
Our next guest is a serious birder. He's observed well over 2,000 species of birds around the globe, from Brooklyn to the outback and the Amazon to Antarctica.
He says birds are more intelligent and more fascinating than we often give them credit for. And he says by studying their behavior, we can learn more about what it means to be human.
Noah Stricker joins us now. He's associate editor for Birding Magazine and the author of The Thing with Feathers, The Surprising Lives of Birds and What They Reveal About Being Human. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here.
Well, for a lot of amateurs like myself, even though I grew up in a birding family, the cool thing is sort of looking at a bird and going, that's a robin. Or maybe if you're a little more advanced, that's a scarlet tanager. Well, you've gone beyond that and you're looking deeply at bird behaviors. What's appealing to you about looking at the way birds behave?
Yeah, well, so I've been lucky enough so far in my career to spend some time in very remote places all around the world doing research projects with birds, places like Antarctica and the Amazon and Ecuador and the Australian outback. But increasingly, wherever I go, I'm fascinated not just by the mere fact that birds exist in a field guide to be checked off on a list, but in all the interesting things that birds do. And you can sit down almost anywhere in the world and pick any bird and watch it, and pretty soon it'll start doing something interesting. And that means you can observe interesting bird behavior right in your backyard.
And it's interesting that you're talking about looking at birds and how they teach us about what it means to be human, because typically when we look at what it means to be human, we look at the great apes. We think they're the animals that we have the most in common with. Why do humans have anything at all in common with birds?
Well, if you start thinking about it, birds and people, we need the same basic things, you know, food, water, shelter, a family, maybe like the desire to leave a legacy. And so... It's been interesting in writing this book and studying birds in different places. The more I spend time with birds, the more I just find myself comparing them to humans. And I think that's been a trend in the past couple of decades in science, is that, you know, historically we were so focused on what differentiates people and humans from other animals and makes us unique. And that's flipped around recently, and now we're starting to see, okay, well, maybe more similar to other animals, including birds, in the rest of the world than we often thought.
One of the birds you start with is a bird that we take for granted, or at best we probably think of them as a nuisance, pigeons. Now, they seem like they're everywhere, especially where there's garbage or something like that. But you found a lot to be interested in when it comes to pigeons. What is it about the pigeon that strikes you as so interesting?
Well, I think pigeons are fascinating. You know, as bird watchers, we are trained not to pay attention to pigeons because they're trash birds and they don't get much respect. But pigeons are everywhere, especially in cities around people. And I think they can teach us some interesting things. You know, homing pigeons are exceptionally good at finding their way home from distant locations. You can put a racing pigeon in a box, take it a couple hundred miles from home, and release it with no point of reference, and somehow magically they make it back home. And, you know, that's one thing that if we as humans had as an ability, we'd probably be inordinately proud of. So I think maybe most of all, pigeons can teach us a lesson in humility, because they're capable of things we could never even dream of.
I had no idea until I read your book that there was such a thing as a racing pigeon. Can you tell us a little bit about that subculture and what people do with these pigeons?
Yeah, so racing pigeons go way back to the times of emperors and kings, when people had to send messages across long distances, and they would train pigeons to carry messages attached to their legs and use this magical ability of pigeons to find their way home. And so they would even be used in wars and flown across enemy lines. There were whole squadrons of carrier pigeons used in World War I and even in World War II when radio was coming out, because there were certain situations which required radio silence. Since World War II, the whole sport of pigeon racing has mostly gone to hobbyists, but there's still a lot of people around the world who raise pigeons and train them to fly home to their home loft and then compete against other pigeon owners to see whose pigeons can fly home the fastest.
Wow. So how fast does a pigeon fly? I mean, they're not exactly speed birds, right?
they're not the speediest birds in the world. I'd say a pigeon can probably cruise along at about, 30 miles an hour or so.
It's respectable. Faster than people, I imagine.
Yeah.
There was one story about a pigeon that I wanted you to tell. You mentioned pigeons being used in wartime, and there was a pigeon that saved something like 200-plus lives in, I think, World War One.
Yeah, this pigeon, I forget its name, it was called Cherami or something like that, and it was carrying a message that was very important to this military operation, and it flew in enemy territory and was shot, and one eye was blown out and its leg was shattered, but it still managed to make it and deliver its message and saved something like dozens of soldiers' lives. And so it was actually given a war cross, and I think it's maybe the only bird ever to get a serious military medal.
That's amazing. And then they stuffed the bird and put it in the Smithsonian.
That's right. It's in the Smithsonian now.
I don't know if that's a fitting end or not.
Well, I think so. I think that's a place of distinguished honor for a pigeon.
Definitely a place of history, so I guess there's that. Something else I want to talk about, moving on to a different bird, snowy owls. Now, Wisconsin has been at the leading edge of snowy owl eruptions in the last couple of years, the idea being that they leave the Arctic, their natural feeding grounds, habitat, and come south. And usually we think it's because of food shortages. What are we learning now about snowy owls and that behavior of the moving south and wandering?
Well, this winter has been an awesome winter for snowy owls in much of the U.S., especially the central and the eastern parts. And every few years, for some reason, snowy owls, which live in the high Arctic, show up in the dead of winter far south of their usual range, even as far south as sometimes places like Texas. And for years and years, the standard explanation for why these eruptions occurred was food shortages. Snowy owls are known to mostly eat lemmings in the Arctic, and people thought that, well, maybe that was a really bad summer for lemmings, and so that owls didn't have any food to eat, and so they would have to fly farther south to survive the winter. And now we're kind of finding out that maybe that's not the case, that, in fact, it's quite the opposite, that it was a very good summer for lemmings and for snowy owl production in the Arctic. They all had lots of chicks in their nest, and so there's many more owls than usual, and they're essentially just spreading out to find some extra space. And just in the past couple of years, we've been attaching GPS satellite tags to snowy owls that show up in the U.S., and it seems like most of them, as far as we can tell, make it and fly back up to the Arctic the following summer.
And that's interesting, because a lot of times it gets covered as the owls are starving and they're getting hit by trucks and they're being harassed by birders with big cameras, and it's not a pretty story, but you're saying maybe it is.
Yeah, I think when we see these eruptions, we should actually see it as a snowy owl success story, because it's been a very good year for them, and just enjoy when they come and hang around us for a while.
So what does that tell us about being human?
Snowy owls, I think, are an example of a bird with wanderlust, because it seems like they can cover thousands of miles with almost no sweat. Like, it takes some energy for them to fly that far. But even in years when it's just an average year and we don't see any in the U.S., in the southern parts of the U.S., snowy owls will fly thousands of miles west and east across the Arctic. And there have been owls that have been tagged in Canada that have gone all the way to Siberia and back. And they seem to be very nomadic. And there are still a few human cultures in the world that are also fairly nomadic in response to the same sort of conditions, people who live in deserts or very harsh, extreme environments like the Arctic. And so snowy owls seem to have this sort of wanderlust that's also present to some degree in people. And there may even be a genetic basis for some wanderlust behavior in people, which could even be related to the first people leaving Africa. So I think that is all very interesting.
That is interesting. And we just got to say, since we're talking about snowies, that once you've seen a snowy owl, you never forget it. They kind of blow you away, don't they?
They're incredible birds. You know, Harry Potter had a pet one, and you look into their eyes, and it's just this piercing yellow color that seems like it's going all the way down to your very soul.
Ah, Yeah, they're awesome. I saw one a winter ago, and they are spectacular birds. Well, we're talking right now with birding expert Noah Stricker, sharing stories of bird behavior and talking about his new book. It's called The Thing with Feathers.
And you can join in the discussion, too. Have you observed some bird behavior that puzzles or fascinates you? Do you find pigeons fascinating? And what is it about birds and bird watching that makes it all so interesting? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the hidden lives of birds with birding expert Noah Stricker, author of The Thing with Feathers.
And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Have you observed bird behavior that surprised you or puzzled you? Do you have a question about birds in general? You can call at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And we're going to go to Peter, who's joining us from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I just wanted to tell you that I found a pigeon egg, a fresh pigeon egg on the ground this morning down in Iowa County, Wisconsin. It kind of seems odd that you know, nothing's growing, nothing's going on, but pigeons are starting to lay eggs already.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that? I'll hang up and listen on my car radio.
All right. Thanks, Peter. And Noah, what about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, pigeons and doves particularly are known for nesting throughout the year. And like other birds, they tend to nest more often in the spring and summer. So I see it might be slightly unusual to find a pigeon egg this early. But pigeons nest in very urban environments. So unlike birds that are out in the forest or field somewhere, which are depending on natural food, which is going to be more abundant in the spring, pigeons can get all the French fries they want year-round, so they may be able to pull off a nest any time of year.
Ah, interesting. And I want to talk about another bird that you cover in your book, the chicken. Now, this is another bird that I guess chicken fanciers are getting more popular and people like to keep them in the backyard, but they don't seem that remarkable in other ways. But there's some fascinating stuff that you write about. I, for instance, didn't know that chickens outnumbered people 4-1 starting in something like the year 2000. There's a lot of chickens out there.
Yeah, most people don't know this, but chickens, the domestic chicken, are the most abundant vertebrate animal on Earth. There's more than 20 billion chickens in the world, which is more than any other real animal that you can think of.
Now, are those chickens destined for the fryer?
Mostly, yeah.
Mostly.
I think the average lifespan of a domestic chicken is about 6 months.
That's not a long life. So at least they have some interesting things to do, like peck one another. So tell us about that. The chicken pecking order is something that is complex, but it's also fascinating when you look closely at it.
Well, we tend to throw around the words pecking order anytime we start talking about corporate ladders and, you know, elementary schools and other social situations. But pecking orders are real and alive in nature and serve a purpose. If you look at a chicken coop, inside the coop you'll have, you know, about a dozen chickens usually. And there is a pecking order. The most dominant chicken will always be the first one that eats at the food dish, and then the second one gets to eat, and the third, and so on down the line. And if any chicken tries to jump the order, which they all know and they've all worked out, then it will just get viciously pecked until it goes back to its rightful place in line.
So what does that tell us about people? I mean, do we do the same kind of thing?
I think sometimes we do, and you know, just imagine if chickens didn't have a pecking order inside a chicken coop. It would just be a free-for-all for every meal, and things would be a lot less orderly. So it may be that pecking orders serve a certain purpose in the world. But I will hasten to add that, of course, we are able to communicate and interact socially, maybe with a little bit more dignity than chickens do.
I hope, although not always, not all the time. Let's go to a caller from Madison. This is Jean on the line. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I heard the conversation about homing pigeons, and I wish my husband was available. He's raised and raced homing pigeons for over 40 years, off and on. And I just wanted to make a comment. He talked about 30 miles an hour. My husband finds that the average, he and his flying buddies from the club, they average about 45 miles an hour. And another fact that's really interesting that we find, my husband actually had a bird return home in a day, 600 miles.
600 miles in one day.
600 miles
in one
way. Yeah, that's amazing.
A long way in it. Yes, it was unusual. They usually don't. They go down at night when it gets dark. They don't fly. And then many birds will come home the next day. We've had a bird come home a year later.
Wow.
So we've had lots of fun experiences, but I just wanted to share that they do average 45 miles an hour.
All right. Well, thanks, Jean. The humble pigeon, a lot speedier than maybe we thought. 45 miles an hour is pretty decent for a pigeon.
Yeah, that's pretty fast. You know, most songbirds are 30 or 40 miles per hour, somewhere in that range, and I guess pigeons are a bit faster than I thought.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Jean. And I want to talk a little, let's get away from the domestic birds now, and we were talking chickens. What about parrots? I understand we can learn something about our love of music from parrots.
Yes, you should go to YouTube when you get a chance and type in Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo and see what comes up. There is a video of this cockatoo that just goes at it to the Backstreet Boys. And it's bobbing its head and slamming its feet up and down and shimmying from side to side and just rocking out to this music. And it's funny to watch. It's had like millions of hits, this one video clip. But there was a neuroscientist a few years ago who saw this on YouTube and thought to himself, huh, that's interesting. I've never heard of a bird dancing to a prescribed auditory beat before. And so he decided to do an experiment to see if this snowball could actually time its movements to a synchronized beat. And so he slowed down and sped up that same Backstreet Boys song and then videoed the bird dancing to it at various speeds. And sure enough, more or less, the bird was able to alter its movements and dance in time.
Wow.
Which is pretty interesting because that's never been shown in any other non-human animal before. And this is something that parrots don't really seem to do in the wild.
Because there's no Backstreet Boys in the wild.
There's no Backstreet Boys out in the wild. And so it seems to show some kind of cognitive, you know, mental ability to train its movements to an external beat. And that probably has something to do with the brain, and it could even be connected to our ability to dance to a beat. And when you get into that, you're suddenly studying things like why do we have music at all in the first place? And even where does language come from? These things are all very closely related.
Okay, and we've got a link up to Snowballs grooving to the Backstreet Boys on the Central Time Facebook page if we want to look into that. Interesting that the parrots can keep a beat. That's a new one. And I want to ask you, there was a recent discovery, I don't know if you know anything about this, they're calling it the chicken from hell, a big sort of fossil find of an ancient chicken. Do you know about that one?
I have not heard about the chicken from hell, no.
All right. Well, maybe Gene Purcell, who told me about it, made it up. But we'll have to look.
Hilarious.
We'll have to look online for that one and maybe cover it later. Well, as we run out of time here, I do want to ask you, though, you've seen a lot of species. Do you have a holy grail bird that you really want to see someday?
Yeah, you know, the bird I've always wanted to see in the wild is called the harpy eagle. And these eagles are feet tall. I mean, they come up at least to your waist or higher. And they are intimidating. Their main diet in the rainforest, in the jungle, is monkeys and sloths. So they basically fly around picking off monkeys all day long and eating
them.
Their legs are as big around as your wrist, and their talons, if you spread them out, are as big around as a dinner plate. So they are awesome birds, and they're very rare these days. They need big patches of unbroken, fairly pristine rainforest, and so you have to be pretty lucky to see one.
So that's a harpy eagle.
Yeah, H-A-R-P-Y, and they're an amazing-looking bird, too. They're black and white, and they have this spectacular crest, and they're just huge.
Wow, they sound amazing. And I want to talk about one other aspect before we let you go. Self-awareness is something that's often seen as uniquely human or close to unique. Anyhow, maybe we're learning more about that. But it is something that, as humans, we tend to look at an animal and we judge about how self-aware it is and therefore how closely related it is to us. Do birds show signs of self-awareness?
The question is, when an animal looks in a mirror, what does it see? And we tend to spend so much time looking in mirrors ourselves and recognizing our own reflection that we tend to forget quite how unusual that habit is. There's not a lot of mirrors out in nature. And from what we can tell, most animals in the world can't actually recognize their reflection. If you put most birds in front of a mirror, they'll start attacking their reflection or trying to mate with their reflection or walking around the backside of the mirror to look for this other bird. But nevertheless, a couple years ago, there was this group of German researchers that decided to try the mirror test, as it's generally known, on a group of captive magpies. And they pretty much showed that two of these individual Eurasian magpies, which are very intelligent birds, were able to recognize their reflection in a mirror because they put a little speck of paint on the magpie's chin, and when the magpies looked in the mirror, they started scratching their chins like, oh, weird, I have something strange on my face, I better get it off. And so the question then becomes, what does that mean? And we know that as humans, when we're about a year and a half to 2 years old, that's when we start recognizing our own reflections. And that comes with a lot of other emotional characteristics.
And like, so we may have magpies that are at the beginnings of self-awareness. But I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, Noah. It's been fascinating.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Noah Stricker, and he's with Birding Magazine. His new book is called The Thing with Feathers.